They care about the colour of his skin. If I kill a police officer, I get 25 years. They kill us, they get a suspension. We don't need that. No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
So it almost appears as if this is turning into some kind of British version of the George Floyd killing that took place in the US last year.
Yes, I mean, the problem is people look at police brutality, systemic racism, as something that happens over there in the United States, far away. But the UK has its own problem of systemic racism, of a lack of accountability. Since 1990, there's been over 1,000 deaths in police custody, and not one police officer's been held accountable, even when the evidence has shown that the person didn't offer no threat or did not have a gun, such as the case of Mark Duggan, the start of the 2011 riots here in London. Now, Amir has come with a tweet. He said, his family and friends told me he recently got married and his wife was expecting a child. It's absolutely heartbreaking for the family. Hopefully justice will prevail. Justice for Mahmoud. And this is an important point. Sometimes when black people from ethnic minorities, they die in police custody, we think about the way they die and we kind of strip away the life that they had before, the fact that they meant something to their community, to their family, and so on. We've got a human rights lawyer that's asking some pressing questions about the circumstances surrounding his death.
Why was he, upon release from Cardiff Bay Police Station, battered and bruised? And why did he die so soon after being released from Cardiff Bay Police Station? And is there any link to the injuries that he sustained that had any cause to his death?
OK, Ahmed, we just have time for one more tweet and then we'll have to move on. Now, what do you have from the online world?
So a tweet from Neil says, a lot of anger in Cardiff, and rightfully so. A young man is dead and there are serious questions about what happened to him while he was in police custody. We need justice, transparency and accountability, and we need it quickly.
We do have to leave it there for now, but thank you very much for bringing us the additional information on what is turning out to be quite a story of massive public interest here in the UK. Thank you. In other news, British researchers have declared that ethnic minorities should be considered extremely vulnerable to COVID-19. According to their research, systematic racism has meant that people from ethnic backgrounds were twice as likely to die from COVID-19 than the UK's white majority population during the first wave of the pandemic. The report explains that people from ethnic backgrounds are much more likely to work in high-risk jobs, which exposes them to COVID-19. Which in turn leads to the higher rate of infection, hospitalization, and death. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has received the coronavirus vaccine produced by China's Sinovac company in a bid to set an example and encourage others. The move comes after reports suggesting the efficiency of the Chinese vaccine is close to 50%, significantly lower than its Western alternatives. Erdogan called on other political leaders and lawmakers to set an example for the rest of the country. More than 50 million Sinovac doses have been ordered, and a Turkish-made vaccine is expected in May. Progressive voices in the US Congress have been widely criticized after refusing to follow strategies to force a vote on Medicare for all during the ongoing pandemic. Robert Inlikesh explains why so much of the US left-wing public are unsure on whether or not to trust the Democratic Party.
The U.S. progressive cry to bring Medicare for All to the U.S. Congress for a vote has been ignored by the Democratic Party's AOC and fellow progressive representatives. Knowing that these same self-described progressives will willingly vote for expanding the U.S. military budget, but never break from their party to grant a substantive policy change in favor of the U.S. public, is it time that we stop viewing these people that say things we agree with or look like us as instant allies? Progressive show host and comedian Jimmy Dore first came up with what became known as the hashtag Force the Vote campaign, in the hopes that the Democrat politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would leverage her vote for Nancy Pelosi to be re-elected as Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi is a pro-war, anti-Medicare establishment Democrat who has a large part to play in not fighting to grant U.S. citizens stimulus payment checks at crucial stages of the ongoing pandemic, whilst allowing trillions to go for corporate bailouts. Jimmy Dore proposed that if AOC threatened to withhold her vote in the House for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, if Pelosi would not grant a vote for Medicare for All, then others would follow suit. In fact, it turns out that the vote to elect Nancy Pelosi did turn out extremely close, and just a few votes would have made a difference. However, AOC went back on her past promises to fight for Medicare for All and decided to shield pro-war Pelosi from having to push for a vote on Medicare for All. Instead, AOC and Democratic Party-funded progressive media went on the offensive against Jimmy Dore for suggesting that the self-described progressive use her political leverage in order to get a vote passed on a bill passed in pretty much every other developed country. With the progressive movement now split by this controversy, many taking the side of Jimmy Dore have been left in despair about the lack of real progressives actually fighting for policies to help the U.S. public. Also, the question has been posed as to why the public should value people who talk a good game and claim a certain identity, as this has turned out in almost all cases in U.S. politics to be absolutely meaningless. Ultimately, politicians are supposed to represent the people who vote for them. People should not vote for someone because that person looks the part or is a good actor. It should be on policy. If that politician they voted for then refuses to push for what they received public support to do, they should no longer be in power. Yet for some reason, people continue to believe in these figures. The same can be said about the right-wingers who support the likes of Donald Trump. Trump was arguing to end the wars and to push a conservative agenda aligned with the values of his supporters. But once in office, the swamp he claimed to be poised to drain became his bath. Whilst U.S. politicians approved billions for the U.S. military to blow up black and brown people all throughout the global South, U.S. so-called progressives continue to obsess themselves with having as many black and brown faces in office in order to do that exact same thing. The reason why it is supposed to be a good thing to have diversity, to have representation of minority communities and radical political thought in government, is so that we can see them represent those views of the communities in question and political movements. If they don't, there may as well all be white men sitting in there in white robes in DC offices, because at least then the enemy is transparent. Progressives have to fight in order to win in government. Just sitting there and getting on camera now and again for attention and to virtue signal, in fact, only works to pacify the left, because they come under the illusion that they actually have real representation.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
The British government has rolled out many different schemes to fight the COVID-19 pandemic's onslaught on its economy. The supposed goal is to avoid mass redundancies and unemployment. But where are the billions of pounds needed to sustain such efforts coming from? The Bank of England is now under scrutiny for printing vast amounts of money, which economists say will further increase inequality in the years to come. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Britons have been sent home by struggling businesses and employers to sit it out. To prevent a spike in redundancies and mass unemployment, the government has introduced a furlough scheme to pay 80% of their wages up to £2,500 a month. In August 2020, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme revived the hospitality industry a little, and businesses have been offered grants to keep their heads above water until spring. But many might be wondering where all this money is coming from. The truth is, the Bank of England is using quantitative easing to keep government borrowing costs down. In other words, the bank is printing money for the government to spend. The adverse effects of the Bank of England printing more than £450 billion to get the country out of the COVID-19 crisis will be felt in the very near future, and by ordinary working people, because most of this money will invariably end up in the pockets of the rich and influential, and very little will trickle down. Whereas before, money flowed in a circular fashion in the economy, with ordinary workers paying mortgages and bills to property and business owners, who went on to spend that money on more assets and living the life, money is now flowing on a straight line from the Bank of England, where it's being printed, into the pockets of ordinary working people, and then into the pockets of the rich. By the end of the 2020 to 2021 financial year, the UK is expected to set the highest recorded level of borrowing in peacetime history.
The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs. And so you're looking at something where the moment is a sort of the pumping of the money is keeping the thing alive. But as soon as you start ending these programs, the realities of a collapsing economy, not just in the UK, the yellow vests, Brexit and Trump are all the result of a fundamental insecurities going on right the way across.
After the pandemic, the rich will go on to buy more stocks and bonds and property, and the surplus money in the economy will lead to its devaluation, pushing ordinary people with fixed salaries further down the economic ladder. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas has accused US President Donald Trump of having trampled democratic rules by denying the outcome of the election and inciting his supporters to storm the Capitol last week. Maas said such incidents should prompt democracies to examine the enemies within and call out political leaders who incite violent rioters to undermine democratic norms. He also highlighted the use of social media to spread lies. Twitter and Facebook both recently made headlines when they removed the outgoing president from their platforms. Well, our final section on today's programme takes us back over to social media, only this time with my colleague Robert Inlakesh. Rob, your first story takes us over to Yemen, I believe. Apologies for that. It appears we're having some audio issues. However, I'm sure Robert Inlakesh will be joining me once again very soon. The topic which we are going to discuss will be the ongoing war on Yemen. Obviously, the United Nations has issued a stark warning to the US following their designation of the Yemen's Houthi Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization, which they plan to do this month. The UN has warned that if the US goes ahead with this move, then it could lead to a famine in the region, the likes of which hasn't been seen for over 40 years. I believe I have Robert Inlakesh back on the line. Let's bring him in now for more on this story. So, Rob, I just introduced your story. Perhaps you could give us the details. What's social media saying?
So we're going to go straight over to social media right now and look at what people have been saying online to what you've just outlined there, a horrific circumstance. First of all, we've got from Anthony, who says, all to spite the Biden administration and hand a parting gift to Saudi Arabia, etc., Secretary Pompeo will go down in the history books as one of the most loathsome, villainous, evil people to serve in any capacity at the State Department. I hope you suffer what you've prescribed for millions. We've got another one here as well who says, it's absolutely tragic. It's unbelievable that the Trump administration could have this started under Obama. Biden, oh, shoot. Yeah, Trump didn't help it. Trump is awful, etc. Lock him up. But this only happened because Obama started supporting it first.
Now, Inlakesh, I have time for just a little bit of analysis from you on this. What do you think is going to happen with Yemen once Biden comes in?
Well, this is an interesting one. Many are speculating that Joe Biden wants to try and get back into the JCPOA and also negotiate to have a peace settlement inside of Yemen. If that is going to go ahead, he needs to undo this designation of Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization, also its leaders as well, or else it's virtually impossible for it to get done. And also, if he is going to allow for aid to continue to go to Yemen via U.S. charities, the United Nations, then he has to undo this move. So all eyes on the Biden administration coming into power in just under a week now.
Well, we have to move on to your second story now, but an equally interesting one. It's an area of your specialty, Robert, I believe.
Yes, and interesting developments that we're seeing inside of 48 Palestine, or what some people would call Israel. Netanyahu attempted to go and deliver a speech inside of Nazareth, which is populated primarily by Palestinians, and was met with large protests as he attempted to do this. What was interesting to see is that Palestinian Israeli citizens, members of the Knesset, were dragged off, who were prevented from even going to the protest. They assaulted Palestinians, grabbed Palestinian flags away from them. This is part of an ongoing trend that we're seeing inside of the occupied Palestinian interior, that we are seeing that Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are rising up on a more frequent basis now, are more angry with the Israeli regime for the way it is treating them. We're seeing this in the Nakba. We are seeing this in Haifa right now, with daily protests ongoing over the Israeli police shooting of an innocent Palestinian, they say, who did absolutely nothing wrong, drove past police, and of course did not injure a police officer. And incidents like this, where we see even members of the Knesset being attacked as well. Netanyahu was attempting to garner votes, and that doesn't look like it is likely. And it also, as well, goes to show that the Palestinians inside of Israel, of Israeli citizenship, are making a difference in that they are voting for the Arab parties inside of the Knesset, and they pose a problem for Israel even forming any type of government, because Netanyahu and his competitors will never accept to include them inside of a government so they can occupy a large space.
Well, we've got a little bit of time for that social media reaction, Rob. Perhaps you could tell us what people are saying online.
The first one we've got here commenting on this says, Israeli police tackles at joint list members of the Knesset and prevented them from attending the anti-Netanyahu protest in Nazareth. We've got another one here as well from a user called Noga, who says, Netanyahu's Nazareth visit, addressing himself to the same public he recently called terrorists and a fifth column. He called on the people there to embark on a new era. He was met with major protests. The police arrested about 10 people, including Knesset members, who are immune from arrest.
Well, we are out of time. There is a lot more to say, unfortunately, but thank you, Robert Inlakesh, for your time today. Stay tuned.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program for a better life here on IRIB English Radio. In the previous program, dear brothers and sisters, we were talking about the sanctity of property and the property of others. And we also talked about the principle within Sharia, which talks about the kuffar, the non-Muslims who wage war against Muslims, that their property does not have any sanctity. But we also said that some Muslims use this principle in other non-Muslim countries, may it be in the East, or may it be in the West, or may it be in some African countries, or South American countries. we are not allowed to use this principle against non-Muslims who are not waging war against us. We are not allowed to steal. This excuse is not acceptable from the Islamic perspective. And the person who does that is actually committing a haram act. So some Muslims have immigrated, for example, to the West or to the East, use this excuse and use this principle for their benefit, which is completely wrong. Why should we not act in such a way in non-Muslim countries? The reason is two. This behavior should not be encouraged because of two main reasons. Number one, on a social level, living as a minority, a Muslim's action reflects the community at large. It reflects on the community at large. Therefore, one should not do so. When I steal as a Muslim in a country where I am the minority, my action reflects on the community. The people will say, look at that person X, or look at that group. There are Muslims and they are doing these acts. So I will damage my deen, my religion, when I do such an act. Number two, on a personal level, greed is a dangerous moral disease that pushes one to commit such acts and commit and transgress more and more sins. By committing such acts, one starts to lose the sense of respecting the property of other people. Today it is a non-Muslim. Tomorrow it will be a non-practicing Muslim. The third day it might be a practicing Muslim which you have differences with, you had an argument with. More importantly, not all non-Muslims are. Those were the main two reasons why we should not do such an act. So the scholars of the deen, all of them say that the sanctity of the property of non-Muslims should be respected. So there is no excuse for doing such acts. When we have clear verdicts where the ulama are saying very clearly that you are not allowed to disrespect or steal other people's property, even if they might be non-Muslims. I would like to refer to the life of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi and what he did, how he treated the non-Muslims at the time when he lived in Mecca under heavy pressure by the Quraysh tribe. Look at the example of the noble Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He first established his credibility. He was known as being Amin, trustworthy among the Quraysh. His enemies, who were putting so much pressure on him, mentally and physically, would put their property in his hands while at the same time they were waging war against him. When the Prophet left Mecca to Medina, or Yathrib as it was known back then, he left Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam as the manager of those properties. And Imam Ali alayhi salam, before he left Mecca to migrate to Medina, he gave back, he returned all those amwal, those properties, to the people who belonged to the Qurayshi tribe, who were among those who waged war against Islam and the Prophet.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings friends of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Imam Ali alayhi salam returned all those properties that were entrusted by others to him or to the Prophet. He returned all those to the owners. Imam Ali himself was highly regarded by the Prophet because of those many good qualities that he had. And the most important among those, as pointed out by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, were truthfulness and trustworthiness. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in a noble hadith, says, "Do not be deceived." Now listen up carefully, dear brothers and sisters. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, "Do not be deceived by frequency of someone's prayers or their fasting, because many a time a person becomes attached to prayer and fasting so much that he would feel uneasy if he neglects it. Instead, the Imam is saying, test them, examine them instead with truthfulness and trustworthiness. Haven't we seen people who fast and pray, but at the same time, simultaneously, they steal? They take other people's property, or they do not give back the money they loaned. Haven't we seen these kind of people? But when the time of prayer comes, you see that they are the first people who rush towards the prayer. They are in the first row, the first line of the prayers behind the Imam. But those same people are treacherous when it comes to other people's property. After all, a mu'min in the ethical sense is defined as one whom the believers can entrust with their lives and property. A companion of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam by the name of Hussein said, "A person from your followers thinks that the property and lives of Bani Umayyah have no sanctity, and now something from them has come to him as a trust. They became among the munafiqeen, the hypocrites. Now this property is in the hands of one of the believers, one of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt." And here, nothing portrays the importance of trustworthiness. The Imam says, "Return the trust to its owner, even if they be non-Muslims." Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. All I need, oh, 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 oh,
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Donald Trump is expected to leave the White House as president on Wednesday, 20th of January, just hours before Joe Biden's inauguration, flying off on Air Force One to his beachside home in Florida. The outgoing president will travel to Mar-a-Lago, where he intends to live. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Luke Harding. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Will Fly to Florida Hours Before Biden Inauguration, Reports Say. Stay with us for more of Luke Harding's article. Donald Trump is expected to leave the White House as president on Wednesday morning, 20th of January, just hours before Joe Biden's inauguration, flying off on Air Force One to his beachside home in Florida. Trump's post-presidential plans have been clouded in uncertainty, but several U.S. news organizations reported on Friday that Donald Trump intends to live at Mar-a-Lago, his Palm Beach resort. His daughter Ivanka Trump and son-in-law Jared Kushner are expected to join him there, at least for some of the time. Trump has said he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration following last week's deadly invasion of the U.S. Capitol. He's expected to leave Washington on the morning of 20th of January, according to a Bloomberg report, citing two people familiar with the matter. The Associated Press, citing a person familiar with the planning, said there would be a departure ceremony at Andrews Air Force Base with a military band, red carpet, and 21-gun salute under discussion. Several White House staff are likely to work for Donald Trump and his family from their new Florida base. According to the Palm Beach Post, Melania Trump recently visited a private school in Boca Raton, Florida, that the couple's teenage son, Barron, is due to attend. Adjusting to life outside the White House may be tough, though. When the president arrives at Palm Beach on Wednesday, 20th of January, roads will be shut as his motorcade threads its way to Mar-a-Lago. Once Joe Biden is sworn in, however, they will reopen. Commercial flights from the nearby international airport that pass directly over his state will resume. It is unclear what exactly Donald Trump intends to do next. It seems inevitable he will spend some of the weeks and months ahead closeted with his lawyers and, as per his presidency, on the golf course. He faces a second impeachment trial in the Senate and a slew of other legal cases, both federal and civil. As an ex-president, he loses his immunity from prosecution. In Washington, Trump staff are busy packing up. On Wednesday, a photographer from Reuters news agency snapped the president's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, carrying a large framed photograph of one of Trump's meetings with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. Other items on their way out of the building included a stuffed pheasant and an Abraham Lincoln bust. The removals and piles of boxes have prompted a rash of puns on Twitter, with several calling on the president to stop the steal. In September 2019, the Trumps filed court papers declaring Mar-a-Lago their permanent residence. Renovations are reportedly going on inside the family's private quarters. Melania Trump has been shipping items for almost 2 months, ahead of her return next week, with one source telling CNN she just wants to go home. Not everyone, though, is thrilled by the prospect of having the former first family move in. Late last year, neighbors sent a letter to the town of Palm Beach saying Donald Trump would violate an agreement made in 1993 that allowed him to convert Mar-a-Lago into a private club. The agreement stipulated that no one could reside at the property, that the Moss family who lived next door complained. President Trump's neighbors in Florida are seeking to enforce a decades-old compact that says Mar-a-Lago, his private social club, cannot be used as a full-time residence, as Donald Trump has suggested he plans to do after he leaves the White House. Neighbors of Mar-a-Lago sent a letter to the town of Palm Beach and the U.S. Secret Service on Tuesday complaining that Donald Trump has violated the 1993 agreement he made with a town that allowed him to convert the property to a money-making club. Per the use agreement of 1993, Mar-a-Lago is a social club and no one may reside on the property, wrote Reginald Stumbold, a lawyer representing the DeMoss family, which has a property next to Mar-a-Lago. To avoid an embarrassing situation for everyone and to give the president time to make other living arrangements in the area, we trust you will work with his team to remind them of the use agreement parameters, Mr. Stumbo wrote. Palm Beach has many lovely estates for sale, and surely Donald Trump can find one which meets his needs. The letter came as Donald Trump's days in office are winding down, and he's proceeding with plans to move with his wife and son to Florida after the inauguration of his successor, President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr., on Wednesday, 20th of January. Donald Trump changed his domicile to Mar-a-Lago in part for tax purposes. Almost immediately, residents of the town began raising questions about the legality of the move, given the agreement the president struck with the town decades ago.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life. a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So, in our previous episode, we were talking about inferiority complex and how to deal with it in children. And we have been talking about the steps to prevent this inferiority complex. And the last thing which you talked about was not to scold them near others, because it could cause very many detrimental effects, like you give others a chance to rebuke the child and the child lose faith in themselves. And yes, so you were telling us more about that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One other way that you can deal with inferiority complex in a child is to show your love constantly.
Mm.
Now that, for example, a parent realizes that my child has this complex in him due to certain reasons, maybe their own reason, their own behavior, or the behavior in the family towards the child, or maybe even, unfortunately, if the father is behaving like that, then the mother should now be extra doing her efforts and show love towards the child in such a way that is very vivid. Okay, every parents of course love the child, and the child is the usually center of their life, but sometimes they don't realize that.
Yeah.
That love is so strong, let's take it for granted that it's there, and then suddenly if something happens, then they start worrying,
then they realize that realize
how much yeah, they are connected to the child. But the child, a good parent is always wanting to assure the child, mm-hmm. that she's there to show the love vividly to the child. So if we want our child to realize that we love them, understand their needs and connect with them emotionally. For example, their need is to feel special on certain occasions, like celebrate their special moments like birthdays. So you should celebrate their special moments like birthdays with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Make them, feel that you are like their age, sharing with them that joy.
That happiness. Yeah. And show them that you care for them. Because at that moment, probably the reasons why you care for them, or what shows them that you care for them, are these kind of things.
Yeah,
because they don't understand what care is. They feel like, oh, she remembered my birthday. She's celebrating my birthday, so she cares.
Yes, exactly. And also, like, for example, being present in special occasions like school, annual sports, or a meeting or something like that. I remember one day when we went to the meeting of my child's school meeting. So one of the child was looking outside the window and seeing that the parent has not come yet.
Oh.
And she felt very bad. She said, if my mother doesn't come, please don't start the meeting.
Aww.
And that really gave me a very, awareness that child at that age, like 4 to 5 years old, realizes that the parent is missing. It's so important for the child that when all children's parents are gathered, that child's parent is missing. So he feels very mad about it, He feels like crying, almost in tears.
Feels like, why isn't my parent here?
Exactly. So children realize these things when the parents miss out, to meet special occasions or their school meetings or something like that. And respect the decisions in weekend planning also. For example, what they decide that is, suitable enough, that what they want to do, to show that you're emotionally connected with them. What their needs and requirements are, you understand that. Spend quality time with them together, like even playing with them. That's make them sure that you love them. It'll make them completely sure that you love them, and you're mentally, and then they are mentally prepared to face any situation,
As
they grow up, then they become strong and confident enough to face other situations that are even negative. But as you said, like that girl who was, so much rebuked outside, but inside she was felt like a queen.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how the feeling should come when the parents behave.
Inshallah, that we're able to do that. Inshallah. Thank you very much. We're just going to take a short break, and inshallah, we're going to continue this discussion after the break. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this series, we have been talking about how to deal with inferiority complex in a child, and you've been telling us some of the steps to prevent this inferiority complex. So please continue.
One of the other ways to prevent this inferiority complex, especially when it is crept in a child, is to share your experience of how you lost and how you felt about a certain event. Or maybe sometimes you didn't try hard enough to, you know, in your school, and then you saw that this was the wrong thing, and how, you know, you felt bad about it.
Yeah.
And then you pulled up your socks and started trying again. So if you share some of your memories of your school days, both sweet and bitter, like successes and failures, then the child will feel that he's not alone. And he'll see you as, you know, like someone to look up at.
Yeah.
So if you don't have this inferiority complex and you're so positive about it, the child will feel, yeah, it's not something that, you know, you feel now you just can't deal with it. He will manage to deal with
and
it.
And generally the child who he looks up at is important. So try and gather those kind of same mistakes or those kind of things that have happened in those child's role models and
yeah.
show them that it is possible, you know.
That's right.
For those people to have made mistakes and come back.
Exactly. That's a good thing. We can also, you know, relate to the child of such incidents, and the child will feel that, you know, these things are part of life.
Yeah.
When you make mistakes, you learn how to avoid them the next time, and you become better and better as time goes by. So positively encourage them to boost their confidence, and, you know, always use language like try again, practice well, don't worry, there's always a next time, and things like that. So, of course, they will never get this inferiority complex in them. Then another way to prevent this inferiority complex in a child is to avoid criticism.
Okay.
If you even criticize them, like, do it in a way to not make them feel that it's criticism. For example, if something was supposed to be performed and there's a mistake in that piece of work, don't look at the bad thing in that. Look at the good part of it. Because the child will feel that now she doesn't feel like doing that thing again.
Yeah.
For example, a child will wash dishes for the parent, and then he's, you know, left them a bit messy on the sides. Look at the bright side that he or she did this action itself in the first
place.
Like
he actually stood up and washed the
dishes.
Yes,
opened the tap, you know, put the soap. Then just a little was left. And then I remember there was a person who was narrating that one day my husband washed the dishes for me, and the dishes were all washed. There were a lot of guests come.
Yeah.
But they were messy tablespoons. You know, tablespoons were a bit messy.
Yeah,
and they were kept in the place.
Stuck on them.
So the wife comes up and says, but look at the spoons.
Uh-oh.
You messed them up. Instead of seeing the bright side, the husband was so much taken off, put off, that he said, first of all, I washed these dishes for you. You're not looking at the bright side of it, that I washed these dishes for you. So what of a child? Imagine, the child's heart is so tender. If the husband, a whole adult human being, feeling like that,
then the
child needs so much effort. The child even feels like that. So if, for example, the child draws something and the parents look at the negative part of it, that the shape is so bad,
yeah,
the child will feel discouraged to ever draw it again.
Yeah, definitely, unfortunately. All right, we're just going to take a short break, and we will be back for more on this just after the break. Stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Okay, welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we've been talking about the steps to prevent inferiority complex, and you've been telling us quite a few, some of them being you should try and share our experiences with the child so they shouldn't feel, you know, that they are the only ones who are having problems in their lives. Or we should use positive reinforcement, avoid criticism.
Avoid criticism and include appreciation in your language.
Okay.
That's very important. And it doesn't cost anything, but it plays an incredible role in everyone's life.
Yeah.
So make it a point to appreciate your child, even if there's small accomplishments that he has made. And this is even more important when you're living in a society with very many kids of your child's age, you know, to appreciate his own work, his own efforts. It's very important to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
So that the child feels that he was appreciated, so he should continue doing that and not leave it. There comes a time that he does something, and if you don't appreciate it, he'll just leave it aside. He'll feel that there's no use continuing this because he doesn't see any kind of effect of it, outside effect.
So, but then we also want to try and show our children that they shouldn't just work for our appreciation, because then they'll always want to do things for people's appreciation. And if they don't get appreciated, they feel like, okay, we don't want to work anymore. So how do we like
that
balance?
That comes later on when the child is mature enough to see the outside world and what is there in store for him.
Mm.
But the foundation should be built with these kind of positive characters.
Okay. You know? So maybe we should appreciate them, but like not overdo
it. Oh, yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Not over flatter them or praise them.
Mm.
Be there for them and let them feel that sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
That you did a good thing. And if you continue, you'll go very far.
Yeah, you're right.
Like that.
Very true.
And then last but not least, of course, there's this factor of expert consultation. When you see that this has gone out of hand, maybe it's a kind of psychological condition that needs to be looked up properly by an expert, then yes, you can take the child to a psychiatrist. If you feel things are going out of hand, seek expert advice immediately.
Yeah.
Emotional and psychological developments are as much important as physical and mental. So sometimes a parent feels that this is just, you know, it's a phase.
Yeah.
But it's not probably a phase. It keeps on and on and on. It then ruins the physical abilities of the child also. I know of a child who was so disturbed emotionally out of one of the parent that the child now faces a very, you know, stomach ulcers.
Oh.
Yeah, it gave up to this. It affected the stomach instead. Because, you know, our emotional state overwhelm our physical states. So emotionally, some person can be so happy that you see even outside he's suffering, but he'll feel he would feel that gruesome pain.
Exactly.
He'll be able to endure it. And the opposite is also true. Emotionally, he's shattered. And outside, even that it takes, you know, a heart disease or, you know, high blood pressure or diabetes or things like that. So they give way to this kind of thing. So we have to be very careful to see and to parent well, to see if our children have such conditions so that it's not too late and get treated, inshallah.
Yeah, inshallah. That's very interesting because I've also come across people who have, you know, suffered these kind of things and it's caused them to have physical problems. So
yeah.
We should be very careful, inshallah. Thank you very much, Sister Salma Khalfan, for giving us your time. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent.
and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.